Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike, Mike Zlatnik. Today, it's my pleasure to welcome Aaron Chapman. I'm a good friend. He's a brother from the Collective Genius Mastermind. We also connect quite often at Jason Hartman's Venture Alliance events. And I saw you last time with Meet the Masters. I guess this is not the day job, but it's the most exciting title. He does rescue work for the Sheriff's Department. That's the most exciting part, I guess. And then part-time, in the spare time, he does a little bit of mortgage origination. He's a lender, pretty successful. I've seen Aaron's team. He's got like 10 or 20 people working for him, and he's a loan officer, loan originator, and he's got a lot of people working for him. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you very much, Mike. I wish I could say what your description of my days was accurate. The rescue is probably maybe 20% of my time, and right now it's just a lot of hours every day going to the finance piece of things. There's a lot of people that want investment real estate, and there's a lot of people want to get that long 30-year fixed money. And it keeps us very, very busy as a team. So I definitely appreciate the kind words. Thank you, sir.
So what do you do for Sheriff's Department? We'll jump into mortgage. That stuff is a little bit boring. It's great stuff, but boring. What about the exciting stuff? You rescue animals. You rescue who? Who do you rescue?
Well, I live in Arizona. That's where I'm based out of. And there is the Superstition Mountains that is just outside of the Phoenix Valley to the east. And that I used to hike it, climb it, do all kinds of things out there. It was a really great recreation spot for me. Back before the crash, I used to do a lot of running, marathons, triathlons, that kind of thing, mountain climbing. And in 2008, I got in a motorcycle accident that put me in a wheelchair for a 6-8 months. And I had to learn how to walk again, get all my faculties back. Wow. When I found that I could make it back out in the mountains and I could climb, I could do all these things, I want to do something more with the fact that I got the return of my legs back. And I stumbled across a guy at a meeting one time who had a search and rescue shirt on. I asked him about it, and he said that he worked with the sheriff's office here in Pinal County. And I asked him where they covered. He said the Superstition Mountains. Well, because of how much I enjoyed those mountains, I decided it's time that I use my recovered body for something more than myself, to take care of others. And so I tried it out. And since then, I've had hundreds of rescues that I've been involved in. I'm in charge of their technical rescue team. I'm in charge of their off-road rescue team. In fact, I formed their off-road rescue team for them. And then on top of that, I run a small team that is responsible for training and being able to rappel out of helicopters and hook into a line to get extracted by a helicopter via a long line up hanging from the bottom of it. So you get to do a lot of exciting stuff. We don't do a ton of those type of rescues. I wish there was more of them, but for the most part, the calls that we get are people who get lost in the night, run out of resources, and we do have some pretty gnarly calls we've had to do that were probably some of the scariest things I've ever done, but you push through it.
This is very important work. This is, I guess, the work you're giving back for what, kind of God gave you back, your legs back, and then you are trying to help others. It's your giving. It's truly, truly fascinating how these rescue projects happen. Most people think of rescue as that movie San Andreas Fault, when the Rock is saving the poor girl stuck in the mountains. I guess that happens too from time to time.
Happens in a way like that. We just don't have San Andreas out here.
Yeah. But anyway, thank you for your work in that. I'm sure it's critical for the community and for the city and for the county. So that's
great. Well, and as you said, it's an opportunity to give back. I received back. It's time to give back. And I think that some people may look at this and say, they don't have that capability, or that's not something that's an interest of theirs. There's so many different ways to give back. We've been blessed as people in our industry and people as a whole with resources that are beyond our physical. A lot of them can be just a shoulder to lean on when people are having a hard time. Many have been blessed with monetary capability. Because of that, I've noticed that the more we give, the better we receive as a result. I actually had an opportunity to be at another gathering this last week, where it was pointed out that you got two bodies of water out there in the Middle East, where you've got the Dead Sea, and I believe the other side was the Red Sea. And you've got both those seas being fed by the same source, but yet one, because it does not filter, that water does not leave the Dead Sea. It stays within itself. You can see that what the end result is. Or the other has ridiculous amount of life in it, and there's many different species of life that you don't see anywhere else. So just a analogy. When you're looking at things, that the more we send out of good from ourselves, the better off we're personally going to be as a result.
Yeah, I strongly believe in the same principles. That's awesome. Well, thank you again for giving back. Let's talk a little bit about the mortgages and where we started. So what's happening right now? Is there a rush to refi with interest rates climbing? Just curious.
I've seen a lot of refi requests. I do see a lot of people just scrambling to try and get those properties they can get in the purchase world, because refi rates are climbing. It's an alarming thing right now to think, stock market is taking its beating. And traditionally, you would see that money being pushed over into the bond market, therefore increasing the capital in the mortgage-backed securities, bringing those rates down. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing people running away from both. And as a result of that, those rates are being pushed up. Where they will stop, we don't know. I mean, it wasn't 2014 since we've seen this. And since that 2014 time, things have gotten much better. And then they peaked out after the election, or right up to the election. And then they've been fighting lower levels since then. And now we're at that lowest levels I've seen in about 3 to almost 4 years now.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. The stock market volatility has jumped tremendously. And the investors have gotten quite nervous, and I think volatility is here to stay. Now, we don't know if the market is going to correct heavily or not. It's already in the territory of correction. But you're absolutely right. The bond market is not seeing the inflow of cash because of the expectations of rate increases. The Fed has set the environment where they promised at least 4 likely rate increases. Many people are saying it's going to be even beyond that. So the consequence of that is the fact that investors are not pouring money in the bonds. If the rate's going to go up, the bond's going to go down, and investors are shying out of it. It's more of a probably psychological factor more than economic factor. They're probably looking for substitution assets. There's a lot of capital out there chasing for the new home, where to go. Go back to what you do day in, day out. You finance a lot of the purchase money loans for investors. Right, that's all
you're
do.
Correct.
They know you're not financing anybody in the owner-occupied space.
I do some owner-occupied. It's not my main target. What I found is when I got in the industry in 1997, we were mainly doing the refis for owner-occupied. And then I found an opportunity in about 2003 to start working with some investors coming out of California into Arizona. And I started realizing that I really enjoyed that conversation more. Less emotion, very much nuts and bolts. I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I'm not an emotion type. So because of that, I was able to communicate in a way that I understood and they understood, and it worked out really, really well for that partnership. And that's where I started building that business. And since then, getting to know various people across the country, my business expanded from just the Arizona area to a national business. I'm in 23 states. On top of that, now international. I work with people across the globe coming into the U.S., and it's not just funding the loans. It's one thing to get the loan done. That's how I generate revenue. But it's really a matter of building their business. I see them as really the CEO of their startup real estate investment firm. And whoever they're working with in that particular area, that's their operations division. They get to buy a cash flowing business for the market value of its sole asset. Think about that. To buy a business, let's just say a person who graduates from medical school and he wants to start a general practice. And he decides, looks at his geographic area where he lives and says, this corner would be awesome. He goes over and drives by and sees there's already a practice there. Now, does he have the capability to walk into that building, evaluate the value of the building itself and all the desks and the computers and the hardware in there, and come up with a number and just hand a check over and say, I'm going to take over the business and I get all the cash flow? Not going to happen that way. Now, that business has been there for, say, 20 years, and it has a patient list and all these things right there that to help this to build revenue. So when you flip on the other side, a person will buy a piece of real estate that's going to cash flow for them, and they buy it for the market value. There's 3 different values that appear on a regular appraisal. There's the replacement value, the cash flow value, and the market value. The lowest of those values is the market value traditionally. So they can pick that up, not just for the market value, but for 20 cents on the dollar. I bring them a business partner in the form of a loan who puts up 80%, yet takes no ownership in the business and none of the cash flow. They get, say, right now today, maybe 5.375% of their 80% in 12 installments. They leave them alone. The investor, who's the business owner, now has an operating business with an operations division, turnkey, and it's cash flowing for them. I'm apply for the CFO job as soon as I meet with them to decide whether or not I have what it takes for their particular business model to help them grow it.
Yeah, Aaron, you identify a number of great benefits of investing in turnkey real estate, investment real estate in these properties, and you're thinking of this as a business where 80% of the money is coming from your uncle, Uncle Sam. Most of these loans, just to be clear, they're coming from government agency-backed paper, right? Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Most of the loans coming that way, is the most popular product, investment type of loans, but secured and guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie.
That's correct. That's where I focus most of my energy at, because there's a huge opportunity with that, since so many in that space don't understand the real estate investor really well. And since they fail to understand it well enough, it gives huge opportunity for somebody who does. Yeah. There's only about a small handful of people in my space that understand how to work with the real estate investor. On top of that, the majority of the banks want to limit to maybe 4 properties for one person. That's it. You know, we work with people doing up to the full 10. And then we work on strategy when you reach 10, on how do we pay those down to help you to expand your holdings, or there's other loan opportunities out there we look at. Not all of them fit everybody, but those first 10, they should fit everybody, because that's where you're getting your cheapest, longest term money. That's where we focus most of our energy. And I have a team of 10 that focus on helping me get that done so I can build the business portion of it with the investor.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Yes, yeah, I guess you're not trying to sell them a loan, you're trying to help their business. That's the right. I think the same way when folks come to us for hard money, my job is never to give them money, but more of a look at the deal and, you know, confirm if it makes sense, if it doesn't make sense. If it makes sense, help them find sort of an optimal finance product. And you do something very similar, but you do it in a long-term money space. We do it in the short-term money space. That's the big difference. Yeah, a couple of questions about your product, because I've gotten a ton of requests from folks asking me for long-term money, but these properties are small. So the strongest cash flow properties, just curious if there's a product out there. So these are properties in all over the country, various markets, but oftentimes they're below $50,000 value, or they're purchased below $50,000. The value may be somewhat higher. Is there a product out there today? What's your minimum? What kind of a loan do you typically offer?
So the type of transactions we typically do will be down to as low as a $40,000 loan size. Okay. Trying to go below that is dang near impossible, because we start violating. We're already, you know, on the verge of violating a lot of your cost to loan size ratio requirements. Yeah. So we're pushing some hard envelopes there. Anything below a $50,000 acquisition price, it's really tough for us.
Understood. So the $40,000 minimum loan is pretty much as low as you go.
That's correct. That's correct. Anything below that is really, really tough.
Yeah, and I wanted to make this comment. I mean, United States has a number of regulatory bodies, and they have, you know, they intend to be to do good service for the country and the people. Unfortunately, what you just point out, some of these regulations on state level or federal level make it difficult to make small loans. And it is somewhat unfair to both investors and to folks like you that they make it difficult, because when the small loan size comes in, there's got to be a flat fee. I mean, the return on your time and you know, a flat fee could violate some kind of a ratio, as you're saying. But in reality, these small properties cash flow so well that the borrower doesn't mind paying a little bit of a higher fee to get the loan. And anyway, I'm not going to complain too much about it. I'm just going to point out that it seems to be those regulations, they're almost discriminatory against poor neighborhoods with lower property values, if you think about it. These neighborhoods might be great opportunities. Investors come in, they buy, they improve the values of those neighborhoods. But the loans are not available there because the government says you as a lender cannot charge more than X percent based on the value of a loan. But when the loan is very small and the work is involved, it's very hard to do it for less than X dollars, right?
You're 100% correct there. When it comes to those sides of a loan, well, one, they say you have to put flat fees across the board. Right. There's no percentages anymore. That came out. Then on top of that, now they say, but it can't exceed a certain percentage. So then they limit our lending capability. You know, and then it gets to a point where investors, they really cannot go into those lower income neighborhoods. One of the things I think that's being missed here, and it was a conversation we'd had with some regulators, and they were talking about us and how many loans we were doing. Because last year I closed 676 units for real estate investors.
That's very impressive.
In multiple different states. Thank you. And I'm the sole loan originator within my team. I have all operations with me. And in that, one of the conversations we had is like, you know, I know that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, they have a certain drive. The word's escaping me right now, but they need to meet certain needs within certain communities, right? They want to have, they want to be able to give into those neighborhoods that have that more difficult time, those parts of the city that are more economically stressed. Well, they're fulfilling that in a way by helping us to provide for investors who will go in there and take these properties and rehab them and then make them rent ready and actually clean up the neighborhoods. I think one of the things that they fail to realize is that our cost of living is going up. Our wages are staying stagnant or going down in many cases if you consider what's going on with inflation. And, you know, I think it was Robert Reich who said in 1978, the median income for the average worker in 1978 adjusted for inflation was $48,000. That was the peak. Well, the last time he gave a figure was in 2011, covering the 2010 year. He said in 2010, the median income for the average worker was like 31 or 33,000 is really low. But what was the cost of living in 1978 versus 2010? It was ridiculously different. You know, a gallon of milk was way less expensive in 1978. But look at what's going on here. When you think about that, there's many of these economies that are wage-based economies. They're not going to have people that occupy the houses there as owners with enough disposable income to put down payments and all the fix-up costs and all the maintenance. They need investors to come in. And that's where we come in and help ensure that the investor feels confident in what they're doing and capable to build their business with that leverage and understand that they're really, I mean, let's think about the whole model here, that they're buying a cash flowing business, 20 cents on the dollar. Somebody else is occupying that space and paying off that other 80%.
Right.
Right. They're paying that down. Well, over that period of time, whether it's 30 years it takes to do that, maybe the property never increased in value at all, just sold for that same $100,000 they paid for. That's $80,000 of profit that they don't have to pay tax on, and they didn't even pay it down. Somebody else paid it, and they got paid a monthly cash flow to hold it. And we think about all the wealth capability in this. It's really incalculable. I think that the cash-on-cash return model is slightly flawed when it really displays what the capability is of the person's ownership of real estate.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. That's one of the best asset classes. I mean, real estate in general is one of the best. It's a very privileged asset class by the U.S. tax code because of the depreciation deduction, the flexibility of high leverage mortgages and whatnot. But we'll probably switch the subject, but I just wanted to comment on what you said, that the Fannie and Freddie kind of mission in life is to help home ownership to go up. But the reality is they disregard investors. So for some reason, they think investors are bad and owner-occupied is good. And it's not always the case. In fact, what you mentioned, those poor neighborhood investors often do great community work elevating these neighborhoods, enabling the products, investment products, to come in into the poor neighborhoods will significantly enhance them and give investors a great, you know, return at the same time, help the community. So I agree with you.
We got to feel blessed that we have a Fannie Mae and a Freddie Mac, because if we didn't, we wouldn't have these 30-year opportunities.
That's right.
So not to talk even remotely down about having them, because I think that we're very, very blessed to have them. And I believe that Fannie and Freddie both need to stay very solvent. And we both read The Richest Man in Babylon. One of the things that says in there that if you're going to lend money out, you need to be sure the individual has that ability to repay. I do not disagree at all with what we have to go through to get somebody qualified for this. We need to be sure that they can repay that, because I don't want to put Fannie at risk, Freddie at risk, my institution at risk, the investor who put their money into the mortgage-backed securities to get a return on that investment at risk, and I don't want to put the buyer at risk. All of those parties need to get their due. They all have a piece in this wheel, but if one spoke breaks on that wheel, then none of the deals work at all. So we have to be very, very cautious about that. The one thing I try and stress for those people I work with, they're going to put them through a lot of misery gathering paperwork to prove that ability to repay, to make everybody feel comfortable with that money. But the one thing I want them to understand is everything they hate to give me, I hate to read. I'm not a big fan of looking at all that paperwork, but it's necessary. This is a job that we took on. And if I don't do that, somebody else will. And I can't guarantee they'll do a good job. I have a duty to take what I have learned and what I have built to ensure that people I work with are taking care of and understand the business and grow it properly.
I think you do phenomenal work, and of all people, I'd rather have you do the loans instead of somebody who could mess it up. And I agree with you. Fannie and Freddie have a necessary function, but they are semi-socialistic entities. I mean, I grew up in the former Soviet Union. I have to say that socialism doesn't work. And I don't want to criticize Fannie and Freddie. I agree with you that necessary. They provide essentially subsidized finance to residential markets. It's a blessing for sure. You can't say anything other than it's great to have those 30-year mortgages at the rates that they are at. So from that perspective, they serve a very important role. So I agree with you. But one quick question. So in the age of increasing interest rates, so we are facing rate increases, and they are inevitable. That's what it would appear, especially given the data, recent data that has come out. Number one, we are at the full employment. So Fed mandate drives them to increase the rates just because the unemployment rate is very low. Essentially, full employment is in force. That triggers rate increases. The secondary piece of data that has come out, inflationary data. And inflation seems to be accelerating. So the chances of rate increases are pretty high. Not guaranteed, but we are looking at number of planned or likely increases. You know, what do you expect is going to happen in your industry? Are the 30-year mortgages going to increase in pace, sort of every quarter increase in the short-term rates that the Fed does? Will 30-year mortgages likely going to be increasing by the same quarter, or is there going to be some kind of compression? What do you think? Are we likely going to see 30-year mortgages increasing at approximately the same speed and pace?
I think that my own personal perspective, I can't really say from a global perspective on the lending as a whole, because there's a lot of it still owner-occupied. But when I'm talking to my investors, those who are coming to me for advice on that, I'm more looking at discussing with them how they need to set themselves up to increase their cash flow or get at least the cash flow that's necessary to make it sure it's a make sense deal. That's where it all makes sense. It's not about the rate, not about the cost so much. It's about the cash flow, and determining what that cash flow is per property is what needs to happen. There may be some adjustments we have to do. I know the rates are going up. They've already gone up, right? And we were locking loans before the election at 4.5, 4.65 for 30-year fixed, 80% loan to value. Now they're like that. They're literally pushing the 5.5 to 5.6 mark right now today, because we've lost over 300 basis points in the Fannie Mae coupon that we pull money from. So that 300 basis points has changed things significantly. But a person can put, say, 25% down if they need to. They may have to adjust their buying pattern, adjust their growth pattern to ensure that cash flow is there. Now, the cash flow is not an absolute necessity. It's something they want. It's something you need to or not only they need, but you should have. But if the deal works and it's proper to have it without it, then that's something to evaluate. I don't ever admonish one to get one without cash flow. I think cash flow is an absolute necessity. But then they can look at the deal from any angles and determine for themselves. Like I said, they're the CEO of the real estate investment firm. But we do have to take a look at it from a different angle. Being able to utilize the 20% down at the sub 5% rates, it's gone now. We need to start looking at possibly 25, even 30, if they want to be able to make the cash flows work and be able to accelerate their business properly.
Aaron, thank you. That's a brilliant point. That's probably the most important point in the whole podcast. One of the most important points, beyond your rescue work, of course. I wanted to stress this point for my audience, because what you said is gold. It's a very timely and very appropriate. So with interest rates increasing, and we didn't talk about scarcity of properties, but for the moment, we will shift there. But for now, assume everything else being equal. When the interest rates are increasing, the property is still cash flowing. But in order to cash flow better, the leverage has to come down a little bit. In other words, investors have to put in a little bit bigger down payment, borrow a little bit less money, decrease their debt service payments, and that probably will meet their debt service coverage ratio or debt to income ratio, whatever one is being used in underwriting. And consequently, the cash flow will increase. They'll have a little bit less leverage. They have to be a little bit more conservative, per se, in each of their investments. But it's still very doable. So they're just going to be buying fewer properties, but with a little bit more money down. Does that sound like, I think that's your strategy. That's what you're recommending to people when the rates are going up. Investments are still solid. The values are still there. The properties still have the upside. But investors just need to put a little bit more skin in the game, per se. Would you agree with
exactly.
that?
Exactly. Instead of buying 10 properties in one city, you can buy 9. You're literally using the same amount of money to purchase 9 and maintaining your cash flows. And then it puts you a little bit longer until you get your 10th one. And then we get another strategy going. So it's not all lost because the rates went above 5% now. I have a lot of people freaking out about that. We look at it from the angles and say, if you just do this a little bit more, it changes everything. That can even bring the rates down also about 0.375% to drop that extra 5%. So not only are you bringing the amount down that you're putting into it, you're bringing the rate down and you're lining your cash flow up. If you have to go to 30%, then you go to 30%, but it's really a different, we just have to evaluate differently.
Yeah, that's a good point. Bigger down payment means better rate, and because lower risk for the bank. So that makes a lot of sense. Are you seeing any challenges with kind of a volume with the number of properties being scarce? All the folks who are selling turnkey properties all complaining about inventories. We finance a lot of the kind of fix and flip part of the project with a hard money loan. So a number of these folks are happily doing good volume and some are doing less. So we're seeing a little bit volume decrease because of the inventory shortage. Are you seeing a little bit of that? Just people buying, on the supply side of inventories. Are you seeing, reductions in the available inventory?
Oh, there's definitely a reduction in inventory. I think a lot of the reduction in inventory has more to do, and I think that the recognized reduction has a lot more to do with the fact that the line that is standing and waiting for that next property availability is much longer than it's ever been. It's kind of interesting how when rates were at their lowest and at their easiest point to get, we had fewer people that were out there going after the inventory and more inventory. Now that the inventory squeezed at its tightest we've seen so far since the turnkey really started making a big explosion in the last 10 years, then we're seeing rates getting to their highest point. We see the lines for people that want to buy turnkey real estate at their longest, right? So it's a combination of all things kind of makes it a little bit, I wouldn't say alarming, but a little bit difficult. Now, the interesting thing here is the rates going up a little bit may slow down this push for acquisition. It may help stabilize the inventory a little bit. I don't know. It's interesting how all these things tend to work themselves out and iron themselves out to more of a smoother flow. And I don't know where these rates are going to end up, but if they end up at a spot that goes a little bit higher there, it's probably going to push prices a bit, because people are going to have a little bit harder time to get their hands on the money. Therefore, the prices might get squeezed, and it may offset some of that rate a little bit there too.
Yeah, that's a good point, that it is very possible that the price appreciation is going to slow down, if not reverse, in some markets as a result of rate increases. I mean, it's a pretty basic concept of real estate. The good old, really old days, when the rates were very high, that was theoretically the time to buy. When the rates come down, it was time to refi. But in the age of rate increases, rate increases, it feels like the basic rules of gravity or rules of real estate finance still apply as rates.
You're correct.
Yeah. So The one thing that I do see, there is kind of revival of the entry-level housing construction. So there are plenty of folks that I know and have approached us, and I'm looking into financing some of these projects that are building ground up, single family or townhouses with the values. We'll give you some examples. So it's almost like, why would you want to build houses in that range? Well, because they sell like hotcakes. So I've looked into a number of projects where, you know, new constructions, 3-2 houses in non-metropolitan cities, obviously smaller cities, but they're cities. And they sell $470,000, $175,000new construction. And these properties are good as first-time home buyer property, where they're great for investors who want to own new property. So there seems to be kind of a revival of new construction. Hopefully it'll meet up the demand. But the opportunity with older stock seems to be slowing down. A lot of them have been rehabbed. And there's only so much you can squeeze out of older properties, because what's happening is the older stock pricing right now has come up. So economically, it's becoming less and less feasible for investors to come in, rehab them, and try to sell them. So the bigger opportunity today seems to be in the new construction. Are you financing any new construction? Is that something that you guys have seen?
Oh, yeah. We've done a lot of new construction across the country. In many states right now, we see a lot of homes being built in and a lot of investors picking up and buying and renting out. So new construction, I agree, is another one. The only thing I've seen is kind of difficult is people finding the land for it in some areas. The areas that have proven to be really, really good markets for the investors, you know, those wage-based economies like a Memphis or something to that effect, they don't have as much land available to be able to build on. So there, because there's a, you think about those parts of the world, that's a lot of private land in that particular, that specific state. So trying to find infill lots, trying to find other plots of land that they can get approved to build on, that proves to be one of the other difficult parts of those areas. But they're starting to make their way through it.
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, I live in New York City, as you know, and I can tell you what happens here. So when land is scarce and difficult, the cities change zoning, and they increase the zoning allowing ground-up construction going up. So instead of single-family or townhouses, you have condos. And they're not as exciting as sexy, but it's housing. And in New York City, that's the only thing that gets built ground-up. You don't see people, unless you're going to live in a house, you're not building an investment property for somebody else to sell it. It's the math doesn't work. So people building their own houses, but all the investors are building condos. So yeah, my two cents here would be that cities like Memphis and many others, non-major MSAs, probably will consider at some point improving zoning regulation to enable sort of horizontal construction, vertical construction, not just horizontal expansion. So
if you look downtown in Memphis, you're actually seeing a lot of that going on right now with some of the older buildings. There's a lot of old buildings down there.
Conversions. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm seeing a lot of that conversion, taking that old inventory and doing that with it.
I think we're running a little bit out of time. So I want to ask you kind of one more question, a really important one, and then we're probably going to wrap up. So the question is there a book, your favorite book? Is there something that you'd like to recommend, something you're reading now or something you read in the past? Just for the audience, what's your favorite book or book that you're reading now?
My favorite book, there's four of them I think that go very, very well together, and I recommend them to everybody. And it's amazing how few have actually read them. So we all know Think and Grow Rich. We all know Napoleon Hill's the book that stands out to everyone. And after that, he actually wrote another book called Outwitting the Devil back in 1930s and put it in a vault. And it was it was actually published by the foundation in 2011. So I just always encourage everybody, if you've read Think and Grow Rich or you've never read it, go ahead and read it. Even if you read it a while back, read it again and then read Outwitting the Devil. After that, there's the transcription of his interview with Andrew Carnegie, which is called Wisdom of Success. That was a phenomenal book. And then lastly, I really enjoyed one by Dr. Joe Dispenza, which is Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself.
Yeah.
Correct. That one is all the quantum physics behind why Napoleon Hill's philosophy works. And so to have a quantum physicist break all that down is pretty dang amazing. You know, and not to extend this out much further, but, you know, there's one concept that really stands out to me that I think a lot of people have failed to understand the real depth of it. Do you remember the book, The Secret?
Yeah.
You remember they talked about the attitude of gratitude and the law of attraction. And many people I hear talk about gratitude in business. And I've seen, you know, I think you and I are both in Colorado together at that Collective Genius event where the speaker was talking about when you wake up in the morning, you get up with, you can't get out of bed, you have three new things to be grateful for. And, you know, you can do that for a month or so, and then you kind of run short on stuff, right? So then you have to start kind of looking, okay, why is this gratitude? What does it make it work anyway? A lot of people just said, well, it makes you feel better. Well, I found myself, and one of the reasons I'm trying to grab on every podcast I can to push this message out there to the world to understand why it works so well to incorporate that particular concept in your life, in your business, in your personal life, in your theological or religious life. There was a time when I had a young employee who we reached a point in the time that she'd been with me to reevaluate where she was at as far as her position with the company and the job she has done. And on top of that, evaluate her pay. And so when I was leading up to this time, I sat down and came up with numbers that I thought would be applicable to give to her as far as a raise in her base and then an increase in her bonus. Then I went on the internet and tried to figure out what is the average out there. And what would you say, Mike, is the average that a person would get for as far as their first bump in pay for a salary? What percentage?
It's a function of, I would say, again, you haven't spent a lot of years in the software, and I've seen it's a little different industry by industry, but it drastically varies. If it's a first bump, first it could be significant, but I don't know, 10% could be a meaningful number. I don't know what's the right number, but it's about right.
You and I agree, because that's the number I came up with, 10%. And when I looked out, the whole world was saying it's 2 to 3%. That was such a little number. I'm like, man, I don't know if I could
do
that.
That's too small, right? Right.
It just didn't look right. And then, of course, what I was looking at was a 30% bump in her bonus for certain metrics. Well, I presented that to the bosses because I don't own the firm. I'm just a loan originator within the firm that is blessed to run a team of great people. I run up the ladder because they have to approve it, and they only approve 2 to 3%. I'm like, wait a minute, guys, that's just so little. They asked me to quantify what she did for the business to warrant that type of a bump. And I had to go through all kinds of files. I had to write up a big narrative. I had to show them charts and progression, all kinds of things. It drove me nuts because I hate that kind of thing.
Yeah.
After a few weeks, I successfully got approved. So I want you to put yourself in this spot. You're sitting on my side of the desk talking to this person. You're so happy that you went through hell, but you finally got it done, and you can't wait to give her this package. We went over what she's done, how good she has, the great job she did, and what she contributed to the business. Now she warranted this. And then I slid this to her. I couldn't wait to see the response because I fought like crazy to get it. And she looks at me, this twisted look, she's like, that's it? You couldn't do better than that?
Yeah.
So what does your gut say, Mike? I'm not asking you what would you do as a leader to coach somebody. I'm saying, what would your gut say? If you could say anything you wanted, what would come out of your mouth?
I did everything I could possibly do under the circumstances.
I love your performance. I love your work. And bear with me. Let's continue to work on this. This is the best I could do at this point. I understand you might have expected a little bit more, but I wanted you to know that personally, I'm grateful. I mean, this is a corporate world, and corporation has the guidelines. And I did the best I could under the guidelines. This is far better than average.
Okay, so that's you thinking as a coach and a mentor. That was you being a boss. Me as an individual and as your gut, I know what your gut was doing because it's probably doing what mine was doing. I was wanting to call you ungrateful little and fill it in, right? Then I wanted I was like, you don't get the raise. You don't get the job. In fact, just leave. You know, that's what I wanted to do. You know, but I did what you just did. I took the calm approach. Said, okay, let's talk about this. I can get behind a person that says, you know, what do I got to do to earn more? Thank you for this, that kind of thing. But I can't get behind that because I worked my guts out and I wanted to take it all from her. I wanted the raise back. I wanted the job. I wanted to just pack your stuff and get out. I was that angry, you know? So, and you, A lot of people ask that. I think for a minute they admit that they had the exact same thought process but didn't want to say it because you want to take the right approach. But if we go with our guts, if the whole world went with our guts, that's what you would do. Well, I found myself later that week exiting the freeway and coming to my office, and there was a homeless guy standing at the off ramp. You know the scene. He's got his cardboard yard sign. Well, years ago, I fell on really hard times and had to scramble around my truck just to find change to get enough gas to get home. And so I've been hiding money in my truck ever since. And I reached where I knew a bill was hidden. I pulled it out, and it was really the only one I had in there. I rolled down the window. I held it out. The man walked over. He took the money. He thanked me. And as he's walking away, he unfolds it. Then he stops and looks back at me, and he holds it up. He goes, "Are you serious, man?" I'm like, "Yeah, why?" He goes, "This is $20, man." I said, "Yeah, it's yours." He walks back to me, takes my hand, which was still sitting up on the window like this, takes my hand, pulls it towards him, bows his head, and audibly says a prayer of gratitude to God, and a blessing on me for helping him. And then as he finished his prayer, he raised his head with tears streaming down his cheeks, thanking me profusely for changing his life. Now, at that time, an overwhelming sense of guilt hit me that I only had $20. If I had the $10,000 a year increase I gave her, I would have willingly give it to him.
Yeah.
I actually even thought, if you have a square, man, I'll swipe my card, because his response of gratitude was so overwhelming that I would have given him anything I could. Well, since at that point, the light turned green, I went forward, and then it hit me as I turned the corner that that's how gratitude works. One person I gave much, and because of responded, I wanted to take all that I'd ever given back.
Yeah.
This other one, I gave him little, and because of the response, I wanted to give him all I had. It works that way with us. If we would go around with a sense of gratitude for everything we receive, and true, real gratitude, not this fake BS that people love to do, true gratitude. And that's what I love about working in the South. You hear that from people. They always tell you how they appreciate you, and you want to do everything you can for them. And that's why I think that if we as a culture start incorporating that, we would continue to grow. We become a better people. Anyway, we'd be more content with what we have, but at the same time, we would receive so much more. And that's a message I think the whole world needs to receive and understand, that we are misusing the attitude of gratitude. And what I did was I took that presenter's message of being grateful for three new things, and I changed that from being grateful for three new things to understanding that I get three new things every day. I get a person referring me business, and a person I get to talk to about the expansion of their business and the growth of their business. Those names get written down on a piece of paper. At the end of every day, I do exactly as that homeless man taught me, was to offer a prayer of thanks to God for those individuals and a blessing on every single one of them. And I get that opportunity every single day, and I'm giving that to you as my gift to you, Mike. If you start incorporating something like that into your life, it will change not only you, but your business and everyone around you.
Thank you. That was very soul touching. I too believe in humble, thankful living. I share your thoughts here. And that was a beautiful, beautiful message. I really appreciate this. I hope the audience appreciates how humble you are and how grateful you are. And that thank you message and the contrast between somebody who got a lot and wasn't grateful for that, and someone who got very little and was so thankful. It makes a big difference in life. People who have what it takes to appreciate what they have versus those who continuously desire for bigger and better things, and then they can never be grateful. So that's a very, very thoughtful message. Thank you. We're running out of time for the audience. Would you please tell how would they reach you? If they wanted to buy investment property and need to get a mortgage, what's the best way to reach you? Is that website, email, phone number, and whatnot?
Well, the best is just go to the website, aaronbchapman.com. So aaronbchapman.com. So aaronbchapman.com. You can also look me up at Security National Mortgages website and find me on that. Also, my email address is aaron.chapman@snmc.com, as in Security National Mortgage Company.com. And I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to have me on here, Mike. I care a lot about you. You're a very close friend. And anything I can do to help further your goals here, I'll do the same.
Thank you, Aaron, so much. I'm grateful for your time and for your advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fun Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.